Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Amanda Hesser. She has just published the essential New York Times cookbook, Classic Recipes for a New Century. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
I am so excited about this. I've enjoyed your writing over the years about food, and this is just a gargantuan, mammoth project. What did it take, about 6 years to do?
It took six years.
I think many folks that are into cooking and cookbooks, when they think of the New York Times cookbook, they think of Craig Claiborne.
Yeah, as they should.
Tell us about the genesis of this project and how it's different than what Craig did.
Yeah, it's very different. So Craig's book, which was published in 1961 and which was a huge hit and really a seminal cookbook of its era, really, it's a terrific book still. And I think, you know, maybe new generations of cooks don't know that necessarily, and I highly recommend they pick up a copy because it's still very relevant and a great collection. And it had about 1,000 recipes, but they mostly came from the Times recipe pages from the 1950s. And so when I set out to write this book, I originally was thinking that I would kind of bring people up to date and really cover the time period from the Claiborne book till the present, because so much has happened in our food culture, and the Times had covered it all, and there were just amazing recipes published in that time period. But what I didn't realize was that the New York Times had been publishing recipes since the 1850s. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do this big project, why don't I just cover the whole thing? Because surely there are great gems that have been kind of lost to time throughout that time period. And in fact, that was definitely the case. And so I tried to collect in one volume all of the best and sort of most noteworthy seminal recipes from 150 years.
And you also got a lot of input from New York Times readers.
Yeah, this was really key to me being able to even tackle this project. Was I put a notice in the New York Times asking people what their favorite recipes were, and got this avalanche of emails and letters and people sending in their original tattered clippings telling me what their favorite recipes were and what they meant to them and how they've been cooking them and how they've tweaked them. And I really kind of saw that there was this incredible kind of community of cooks out there that really had been following the Times for decades. And what was really interesting about what they sent in was it ended up being 6,000 plus recipe suggestions, which I collated. Actually, I didn't know. My friend Meryl Stubbs, who helped me with the whole book, collated them into a document. So you could see, like, the patterns. You could see what we really love to eat, the sort of categories of food, and then the specific recipes that really resonate with Times readers. And so you could see that we love cheesecake, and we love any dessert with apples, and we love meatloaf and butternut squash soup and gazpacho. And, you know, there's just specific dishes that everyone seems to kind of love and has for years. And so it really ended up being kind of my cheat sheet for the archive from the 1960s forward, because I could go to it, and I did again and again and again, as a reference for, you know, if I was, you know, wanted to include a creme brulee, I went to that document to see, like, what creme brulee recipes readers had recommended. And, of course, the one that was most popular came from Le Cirque, the sort of famous New York restaurant.
And you'd only just begun, because clearly you didn't have readers out there who could say, oh, yeah, I remember in 1898 you had this recipe.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Then I had the daunting task of, after I got through this sort of 1960s to the present day, of having to go back and figure out from 1850 to 1960 what recipes kind of mattered. And again, Meryl did this amazing thing, and she wrote down every recipe that the New York Times printed from 1850 to 1960. And you could see the trends and the things the patterns of what recipes were popular. And it also gave me a chance to then, like, look at something like clam chowder, for instance, which comes up a lot in the 19th century archives, and look at a bunch of different variations before deciding which one to test. And also, there were just so many amazing recipes from back then that just, you know, A, you wouldn't expect necessarily to find, and or B, just really kind of interesting and have gotten buried over time. So, like, for instance, there was a great recipe for Worcestershire sauce, like how to make your own.
Oh.
And it doesn't come out like thick, like the sort of the and viscous, like the Worcestershire sauce that you and I know, but it's delicious. And actually, I know a number of people who have made it now that I've reprinted it, and they love it. You know, it's this incredibly delicious condiment. And then there are things like dulce de leche, which is something we think of now as, you know, having been kind of revived by Haagen-Dazs and their ice cream. And in fact, you know, there's a recipe from the 1870s for it in the New York Times.
In case you've just tuned in, Amanda Hesser joins us, and she has just published the Essential New York Times Cookbook. Many of us are grabbing our cookbooks right now as we get into the holiday season and looking for those special recipes. And this particular cookbook is an amazing undertaking. And once again, we've just begun because you had to cook all of these recipes and try all this food and then test it out. And your family really helped out, didn't they?
Group effort. You know, yeah, I mean, I cooked so much. You know, Meryl and I tested 1,400 recipes together. And then, of course, anytime I was on vacation with my family or at a holiday, I was cooking New York Times recipes, and then roping in my family members to also help me test them. So, yeah. And it was actually really great because I gave birth to twins while I was working on this book. And so their first food was all of this great food from different decades. And so they have definitely varied palates at this point.
So you could get every one of these recipes and process it into baby food.
That's right. That's true. I did. I thought, well, I'm so busy in the kitchen, I'm not going to be able to cook other food, but I want them to eat well. So I just basically took the recipes as I was making them and, you know, saved some for my husband and me and then the rest period for the kids.
I love the way you've laid this cookbook out because you go through all these different sections and all the recipes are in chronological order as they were originally printed in the New York Times. And you begin with a section called Drinks, Cocktails, Punches, and Glog. And you had me from the very first second I looked at the picture of Senator Huey Long holding the cocktail shaker.
That comes from a 1935 story when Huey Long flew to New York and flew a bartender from New Orleans to New York to, I don't know, he was railing against some other politician or some bill or something. And
FDR, I believe.
Was it? Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah,
and he, in order to kind of get his point across, he gathered a bunch of journalists at the New Yorker Hotel and made them, and had his bartender make them all a proper Ramos Gin Fizz.
Hmm.
And this, of course, prompted lots of readers to write in and say, he's wrong. Not only is he wrong about FDR, he's wrong about the Ramos Gin Fizz, and here is the right recipe. I thought that was a great moment in the New York Times and also a great moment for U.S. politics.
And as we move through the various food and beverage groups, we do see a lot of Craig Claiborne's recipes. As we get into hors d'oeuvres, snacks, and small dishes, you have his Swiss fondue recipe.
That's right, which actually was published before he even was a writer for the New York Times. He was kind of celebrated as a food person by the food editor at the Times, and then he was hired shortly thereafter. I think that the thing that was really fun in cooking from all of these recipes was actually getting a chance to really dig in and get to know all of these writers whose work has been in the Times for decades. So Craig Claiborne, for instance, Pierre Franey, whose recipes I really adore. He's very precise but accessible. Mark Bittman, you know, who we all know now as the minimalist column, and you know he's a master of using great technique to take what seem like simple dishes and make them more sophisticated. And Molly O'Neill, who really introduced lots of different cuisines to us in the New York Times Magazine in the late 80s and 90s.
I interviewed Molly about 15 years ago for one of her cookbooks. She was still at the Times, and you're right. There's so many great food writers and cooks out there, and there was kind of a dead zone, wasn't there? As you went back through time, you allude to this in your introduction. There was a period there, was it the 30s, 40s, in that area where cooking just kind of fell apart?
Yeah, it's hard to know exactly what was sort of just a reflection of the New York Times priorities, you know, with food and what was sort of happening culturally. I wasn't able to totally unpack that, but certainly the Times really stopped covering food in the late mid-20s to through the 30s. I mean, they did in bits and pieces here and there, but there was no dedicated food column. And then when they sort of returned to food during World War II, and they were very focused, obviously, on like how you could cook with the materials you had at hand and rationing and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then into the 50s, like when the food returned, it was very different. There was less enthusiasm around eating well and sort of getting it and just sort of getting it onto the table, you know. And it took Craig Claiborne, who was then hired in the late 50s, to bring back the sort of love of food and make, you know, food aspirational and stylish, and he really made the food pages a must-read.
Over that same period of time, I'm going to guess that food processing had changed tremendously, too. We started having frozen foods and more canned foods and prepackaged foods, and that would have changed the way that people cooked.
Yes. Well, and also there was a great story by Sheila Hibbins, who wrote also for The New Yorker, and I believe it was like the 1940s. She wrote about how it had actually become kind of a status thing for women to say that they didn't know how to cook.
Oh.
And she wrote a piece about how she thought this was absolutely wrong. And that this was a bad direction for us to go. And it turns out, of course, she was right. Of course, for the time period, there's no mention of men cooking, but she was very concerned and, I think, sort of prescient with her views.
Amanda Hesser joins us, and she has just put out the Essential New York Times Cookbook. Looking back over cooking, say, the last 20 or 30 years, it seems like 30 years ago, cookbooks were written for cooks, but now we have a lot of cookbooks that are being written for anybody to understand, where things are more explained because the person reading the cookbook might not really understand the terminology. How do you feel cookbooks have changed over the last 30 years?
That's a great question. I do agree that there is the dominance in cookbooks is accessibility, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. But there is a little bit of a sense of, in that accessibility, of a kind of talking down to people. And I think that that's a little unfortunate. But I think in an effort to be accessible, it's welcoming more and more people into the kitchen. And I think that's been a great thing. But I fear the loss of cookbooks that have kind of challenging recipes. I do think that there is a strong thread of kind of maybe what I would call purist cookbooks, you know, cookbooks that are like about charcuterie, like how to make your own charcuterie if you're that ambitious or you are that obsessed with one particular topic, or, you know, these kind of specialized topics. And I think that's great. I feel like generally everything is heading in a very positive direction in our food culture. I think that, you know, not only are people interested in food, but they are becoming more and more knowledgeable about food and gaining expertise in specific areas. And I don't see anything bad in any of that.
One of my favorite sections is the one for potatoes, corn, and legumes. I'm a big fan of the potato, and I really love the fact that you go back for these old recipes, because there's so many food ingredients that are just not politically correct for whatever reason. And I stopped and gasped when I saw the recipe from 1879 for larded potatoes a la New York Times.
Well, that's a great recipe, because you're supposed to use a larding needle, which probably no one in America owns anymore. You would lard meat, you know, lean cuts of meat with lard and old days of cooking. But this recipe called for doing that with potatoes. Now, I have tried it with a larding needle, and I can tell you that you don't want to be using a larding needle because it's really hard. But you can use an apple core, and you basically kind of just drill holes into your potato and then stuff them with, well, back then you would use lard, but I used bacon. And the thing that's kind of was fascinating to me about that recipe is that Jamie Oliver published a very similar recipe just a couple of years ago in one of his cookbooks. And he essentially did the same thing where he used an apple core to core hole into the potato, and then he stuffs the hole with bacon but and lots of herbs and other little things, other tasty treats, and then plugs the hole and roasts the potatoes so that when you those flavors as the potatoes are roasting kind of infuses the whole thing. And I just kind of love that here's this 19th century idea kind of replayed through the eyes of a creative celebrity chef.
You tried every one of these recipes?
Yes.
That's an amazing feat. I go through here and I'm thinking I could spend my whole life trying to cook all these, and it's an amazing book. It really is.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a great project to take on because how lucky to get a chance to try that many things.
In the section for sandwiches, pizza, and savory pies, you have one for pizza with caramelized onions, figs, bacon, and blue cheese.
That's delicious. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm having a hard time doing this interview because I don't have I don't have any of this stuff here to try.
Sorry, I could have shipped in advance.
I wasn't thinking. In the fish and shellfish area, you have monkfish encrusted with pistachios.
Yeah, it's such a simple recipe. I mean, you just kind of grind up a bunch of pistachios and dip the fish in it. But it's such a nice complement to monkfish.
In poultry and game, you have something that maybe would be good for all those leftovers from Thanksgiving, Georgia pecan turkey salad.
Yes, that is perfect. And in fact, I think that Florence Fabricant wrote that recipe as a Thanksgiving follow up, and obviously it's great with chicken. It's terrific, and it reminds me that there are three tuna salads in the book. You know, there are a couple of specific dishes that I did a couple of I included a couple of variations, and that was because the readers had really recommended lots of different versions of a dish, and I felt like, well, that told me that they cared about that. So there's a great tuna salad that is made, you know, it's completely oil-based, and it has smoked almonds in it.
Oh, my.
And those pickled jalapeno peppers, which it sounds like strange, but it is truly delicious. And then there's more of a classic one, and then there's a cheddar and tuna salad that is kind of that Midwestern classic combination that's fantastic.
Mm.
And I think there are four gazpachos. So and many cheesecakes, so that you could see how we went from the original first cheesecake in the book is called Deluxe Cheesecake, and I always love that recipe title because, you know, who today would call a recipe deluxe?
Mm.
But it has a actual pastry crust, not a sort of ginger snap or graham cracker crust. And then there's the classic junior cheesecake, which has a great story about getting the recipe. And then when we start becoming more daring with our cheesecakes and adding flavors like mocha.
When we get about 500 pages into the Essential New York Times cookbook, we finally get into the meat of the cookbook. And I didn't realize there are so many different kinds of meatballs in just so little time.
Exactly. It is a great problem with life.
You've got your Roman-style meatballs, and you've got your Königsberger Klopse.
Yeah, which is a veal with a sour cream sauce. Sour cream and dill sauce.
Very German.
Mm-hmm. Delicious.
Mm-hmm. And you've also got the filet de bœuf rôti with sauce bordelaise. Now, this is French.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We've all had that dish in restaurants, and it's great.
Well, I must say, this is going to go onto my shelf of the cookbooks. It's going to go next to Joy of Cooking, which I guess is one of the legendary cookbooks, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And you get into the section of sauces, dressings, condiments, rubs, and preserves. And we actually have a recipe for tomato ketchup from the 19th century. Does anyone make ketchup anymore?
Oh, sure. I mean, actually, I think there are a lot of artisan ketchup producers, certainly. And then in terms of people making it at home, I think there are some ketchup makers out there.
And it seems like the late 19th century, must have been a really great time for condiments because you've got a lot of recipes from that period. Like, here's one for chow chow, which I don't think I've ever had.
Yeah, chow chow is kind of like it's a pickle essentially, and there are tons of chow chow recipes in the 19th century. I think you're right, and I think that's a great observation. Was just that now when we cook a meat, we add lots of herbs and we layer in lots of flavors, and so when you have a finished dish, that's what you eat. And in the 19th century, you often cooked meats in a very plain manner and then accompanied it with a strongly flavored condiment.
And the 19th century also was a really great time for sweets, wasn't it?
Oh, it sure was, yeah.
You start off your section, cookies and candy, with a recipe for butterscotch cookies. And I don't think this is something that I should probably have.
There are lots of ginger snaps. And then there are cookies called jumbles, which were what we think of as cookies, but they were called jumbles then, and lots of cakes, a lot more cakes actually than cookies. I think that cakes were something that you kind of regularly made on, like you would make bread back then, something you kind of had around the house that everyone kind of knew how to cook, because the recipes back then were very kind of amusing to read, because they would never tell you what size pan or what oven temperature you would bake your cake in, because of course they assumed that you knew that already.
When I think about the sweets from my childhood, I think about something like what you have in this book called party balls.
I love that. That's another one of my favorite recipe names, that and Heavenly Hots. But party balls are essentially like Rice Krispie treats, but made in the shape of a ball and made with molasses.
And we're getting into the time of year when we exchange fruitcakes, but you have recipes in here for fruitcakes that might actually be eaten.
The fruitcake in there is delicious. And actually, that was a recipe that was recommended by many readers.
Is this the pan forte?
No, it's the, I think it's called Marianne's fruitcake.
Okay.
And, but the pan forte, that comes from one of my favorite books in the world, which is called The Italian Baker by Carol Field, who really... I think she's the reason that we're all eating ciabatta and focaccia. She kind of introduced us to all of these great regional Italian breads, and panforte is one of the recipes in that book, and it was printed in the New York Times.
My mother-in-law was quite fond of something that they used to make down in Memphis, and she called it jam cake.
Oh.
And you have a recipe in here that I think she would have enjoyed. It's Dick Tober's Cordial Pie.
That is such a fantastic recipe and was a huge hit in the Times. And the story behind that is that the Times published a recipe called Cordial Pie in the 80s. And Dick Tober, who was a statistician in Maryland, read that, and he became so obsessed with the proportions of this that he came up with 20 variations, because it contains a half a cup of alcohol in one pie. And you can basically make any drink flavored pie if you break up that half cup with different alcohols. So he figured out how to make a grasshopper pie and a Brandy Alexander pie and 18 other variations. And Craig Claiborne loved this so much that he printed a chart of all the variations of that pie. And then Dick Tober ended up, it was such a popular article that he ended up printing a cookbook about his cordial pie. I've talked to him actually since then.
Well, I can't wait to try this straight-up rhubarb pie. That's another one that, it reminds me of my grandmother to read a recipe like that.
That is a terrific, terrific recipe, and it comes from a woman who wrote a book called Humble Pie, and she comes from a family of pie makers, and her book is a really terrific read. It's actually kind of like a pie is a metaphor for life, and her pie is, her crust, everything is terrific. It's like not too sweet, not too tart. Nothing fancy, just kind of hits like every note perfectly.
A number of years ago, I did a phone interview with Ruth Reichel, and it was her last day at the New York Times, and we talked about her first memoir, and she fondly reminisced about dumpster diving in Berkeley. And I'm wondering, do you have a wild story like that about a food passion that led you to do something really extreme?
Huh. Actually, the dumpster diving reminded me of something else. I don't know if I have an extreme story, but I was sort of thinking about how, you know, people, when people ask me, like, you know, why I became a food writer, I often think of two memories from childhood, and one of which is my grandmother. She lived on the Chesapeake Bay, and she would, you know, we'd eat a lot of crabs, including softshell crabs, and, you know, to kill a softshell crab, you actually, what you do is you cut off of its face. That's how you clean, you kill and clean it that way. And the best way to do it is with scissors. And, you know, a strong childhood memory is of her kind of crouched over her kitchen sink, cutting the faces off of softshell crabs. And needless to say, I did not eat many softshell crabs when I was young. And her talking to the crabs, she often talked to the food that she was cooking. And she would say, "You don't like this, do you?" And then sometimes she would make little yelps as if she were the crab. And that was just kind of the way it was in my family. You know, food was a significant part of our lives, and, you know, whether or not it was pretty or joyful or otherwise. Sure. And then I was thinking of another story when you mentioned Ruth dumpster diving, which is that my father, who was a great showman, and he was also a car dealer. And if you're a showman, a car dealer is a good business to be in. Mm-hmm. And he would often do kind of these events. And one of them was called the Jell-O Jump. And the Jell-O Jump, the way it worked was he would get a big garbage dumpster, clean, and he filled it with keys. And one of the keys in the bottom of the dumpster matched a car, and the rest of the keys matched much less exciting prizes. And then they would fill the dumpster with orange Jell-O. And he, you know, I remember him standing up in front of this quite large crowd with the sort of local TV stations and sort of welcoming everybody to the Jell-O Jump and then cannonballing into the Jell-O. So it's between the screaming crabs and the Jell-O Jump, it was no wonder that I became a food writer.
That's a great food memory. Well, Amanda, we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Amanda Hesser has been our guest, and she has just published the Essential New York Times Cookbook, Classic Recipes for a New Century. And I know you picked this cover with care because it just asks to leap out of the bookshelf and into the cook's hand. I mean, the color, the design, it's really well done.
Oh, great. I'm so glad you like it.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Do you ever wonder if Afghanistan is another Vietnam? Is that war winnable? Do you ever consider whether there's ever a justification for torture? Is enhanced interrogation ever necessary? These are questions that a lot of us have been asking, and we're going to be talking about some of those in the Book Nook next week when my guest will be Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer. He has written a book called Operation Darkheart: Spycraft and Special Ops on the Front Lines of Afghanistan and the Path to Victory. That's the Book Nook next week, right here on WYSO. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.